Reverend Davis, Reel 1. How and when did you first come to be with the Gloucesters?
Well, I had been the army chaplain at the Boys Battery Royal Artillery Training Establishment in North Wales and was just about to be posted, I believe, to Aldershot when news came, of course, about the invasion of South Korea by the North, and my posting, actually a little to my relief, I wasn't particularly looking forward to going for a year to Aldershot, my posting was changed to Korea, and then I learned that I was to be attached as chaplain to the 1st Battalion of the Gloucestershire Regiment. Actually, it's quite interesting to recall that in that training camp, on the day that North Korea did invade, when I was up in North Wales, I was just listening to the 6 o'clock news on the BBC and preparing to go to Evensong, where I was to preach at the local parish church, Bottle Witham Parish Church, and I heard the news about the invasion of Korea. And at 4 o'clock that morning, North Korean troops had invaded. And I remember feeling, oh, that's going to be slightly unpleasant, but I felt then hardly anything much to do with me, and I remember going off down lightheartedly to Evensong. I've often looked back to that when I realised later the tremendous personal involvement that was going to occur.
How did you actually get out to Korea?
Out by troopship, of course, in those days. This was in the late autumn of 1950. And I think of our voyage really took the best part of 4 weeks. Right from Southampton to Busan, Japan, and I was in Busan for at the holding camp there for about, I suppose, really more than 3 weeks, probably the best part of a month, right up to Christmas Day itself, before I actually was flown from Busan, the short flight, to Korea. So I remember visiting in the military hospital at Kure, Japan. I remember just after Christmas visiting the commanding officer of the Royal Ulster Rifles, who'd been brought back ill before their great battle commenced. And of course, he was in a desperate state because the news was coming through that his battalion were threatened with tremendous casualties and so forth. And I remember sitting at his bedside, and I remember him saying, I can't stay here any longer. Must get up. I must get my boots. He must be allowed to go back. And then a couple of days later, before the year had ended, the last couple of days in December it would be, I flew with a small group of people who were going to Korea. From Busan, and I from Kure, Japan, and I think we ended up somewhere. Perhaps I can't remember where it was. Busan we ended up in, but anyway, we landed in Korea, and after remaining in that place where we came down for a day or two, I went in a jeep forward to try and find the Gloucesters. I remember being accompanied by one Colonel Jumbo Phillips of the 8th Hussars, and also by Father Ryan, the Roman Catholic chaplain, who was also trying to get up to the battalion area, to the battlefront, which in those days must have been south of Seoul. Yes, it would have been south of Seoul. And after a long, tortuous journey in very snowy weather, I got to the Gloucesters 1st Battalion. I remember halting one night at some place which had been rather devastated by fighting, where there were thermal springs. It had been a great watering place. People took the waters and took thermal baths. And I remember going out from the place where we were staying overnight, going out under a star-filled sky in bitter cold and plunging into these in this lovely, warm, open-air, big thermal bath, all this warm, bubbling water. Something I shan't forget. It was a marvellous sensation after all that travel to have this marvellous warm bath and lie there in this quite hot water looking up at these stars in the sky. And then so I got joined the Gloucesters.
In what kind of mood did you find them?
I found them in a very buoyant, practical mood. I was taken by the adjutant to meet Colonel Fred Carr, who is now dead, of course. I buried him in Gloucester in 1987, just after his 80th birthday. I remember being taken up into the commanding officer's caravan and introduced to him. I remember him sitting wreathed, as he always was, in pipe smoke. And the adjutant introducing me, and he got up, came forward and said, "Welcome, welcome, Padre, to the 28th 61st. That was the old title of the Gloucester Regiment, a combination of the 28th Gloucester and the 61st. And there it was. So, and from then on, as chaplain, one was with the 1st Battalion, moving north all the time, moving nearer and nearer to the actual battlefront, and not knowing what we were really going to expect. I can well remember us going through the absolutely battered and half-destroyed city of Seoul. And I can remember, you know, one was advancing past shattered, still-smoking buildings, making your way over fallen telegraph wires and all the rest of it, you know. And ahead of us, one could see the great jagged ridge of mountains which lies to the north of Seoul, and we knew we were going to find out what might await us there. And that must have been in the latter part of February 1951, because of course the communist troops had taken Seoul, as you know, and gradually been pushed out again in the early part of 1951, and they were pushed back north of the Indian River again. So we were now advancing to the battle positions on the south side of the Indian River. The Chinese had gone back over the river and well to the north again. So it was the North Korean communist troops who'd occupied Seoul, of course, and created great havoc there. In fact, I believe I'm right in saying they'd occupied it twice, but eventually, earlier in 1950, then again at the beginning of 51, and now they were pushed out, and the battle was to lie some 18 or 20 miles north of Seoul. And we got to our, we had one battle. Was it Hill 327? We called it Dursley Hill after a well-known market town in Gloucester called Dursley. Yes, proud. Dursley Hill. 327. That was the first battle I was in with the Gloucesters, but they'd had one or two, of course, battles with the enemy before Christmas 1950, before I joined them, when they were being driven south by the great Chinese pressure from the north. The Chinese first came in. But we had that battle for Hill 327 must have taken place, I think, well, I could recall that, late February or early March. If my memory serves me right. We had to advance up a very tall hill, I suppose that was Hill 327, and dislodged the strongly entrenched Chinese there. As we went up the hillside, of course the doctor and I went up together with the advancing troops. As we went up, a chaplain once saw wounded and stricken men coming down, being brought down, including later years, he commanded the 1st Battalion. He's dead now, Charles Loring. And we went on and on under Chinese fire, of course, and under covering fire from the Centurion tanks of the 8th Hussars far below. And I can remember the sensation of chaplain going up slowly up this steep hillside and hearing the shells rushing over your head and you praying that they wouldn't fire short. And then, of course, there was Chinese fire coming down, and a number of our men, several officers were killed. One or two of their bodies were not really recovered. Anyway, and then the Chinese opposition ceased. They retreated, leaving dead men in the trenches. I remember the feeling of shock I had on occasion seeing a Chinese rifleman leaning over his trench. And all his face had been completely blown away, but the skull remained almost intact, most uncanny sight. He'd been caught in artillery and centurion fire. And I felt this is an extraordinary example of the tremendous power of an explosion that can really wipe out the inside of a man's skull and leave part of it more or less intact. Anyway, we got to the top. The well was very bitter. I remember the doctor and I creeping into our wonderful Swedish sleeping bags in the open there and feeling the marvellous sense of warmth generating as you lay there under the stars. But there was no further opposition from the Chinese at that stage, and on we went to occupy our final positions just south of the Indian River. So that's the arrival of the Gloucester's great battle, of course, about which you've heard a great deal. And there's no need for me to elaborate much on that. May we stop for a moment?
But can you tell me your own personal experiences in the Imjin battle?
Oh, yes, very much so. One I shall tell you about, there are a number of others, but I think this is quite important. I was at battalion headquarters, of course, with the adjutant, the commanding officer, and the other people who were always on battalion headquarters, and the doctor. And the first information we had that a great Chinese advance was developing was when a young officer who had a watching patrol on the Indian River came in and reported that they'd seen in the moonlight, brilliant moonlight at the time, some 20 or 30 Chinese coming across the shallows. They'd fired into them, a small watching patrol, and they'd counted for a number of those unfortunate Chinese by small arms fire. But then they realized that it was developing to hundreds and hundreds preparing to cross. We then knew that a great Chinese assault was beginning. A company was our most forward company, and that was very quickly under immense Chinese pressure. And Major Pat Anger, their commanding officer, was killed. And a very gallant young officer earned a posthumous VC. He was the young officer who, although wounded, ran forward with grenades in order to nullify a Chinese position from which they were firing. That was, of course, Philip Curtis. He was killed making a desperate lone assault, already wounded against a Chinese machine gun bunker. And the Victoria Cross was conferred upon him posthumously in November 1953. And I had gone to celebrate Holy Communion for A Company before the main assault really began that night. And among the little congregation that was able to assemble, their company commander was not able to be present, of course, but were these two young officers, Philip Curtis and Terry Waters. I've just explained the heroic death of Bill Curtis. Later that day, when I'd gone back to battalion headquarters, and as far as Terry Waters was concerned, he was taken prisoner. He managed to get back to battalion headquarters the next morning with the remnants of A Company, and he died later in the year on the arduous march north as a prisoner of war. And he was placed with a group of others, and one Sergeant Hooper of the Gloucestershire Regiment, in the notorious caves near Pyongyang. They were held there in these underground caves in about a foot or two of stagnant water. And then their North Korean political officers said to them, "There's no need for you to die there. You can come up, and we want you to make broadcasts to the United Nations and to your people." In other words, they were going to take part in North Korean communist propaganda. And Sergeant Hooper has told us later that Terry Waters, who was the only officer with them, a young officer, a young lieutenant, he said to them, "I advise you all to go up and make you whatever broadcasts they want to make you undertake. Try and make them as footling and pointless as possible. But I cannot go up." And Terry had felt he represented the whole corps of officers in the British Army, and that he couldn't go up and take part in any propaganda. He said, "I will remain." But Hooper said to him, he told me later, "You can't stay here, sir." But he said, no, "You go. I've given you my order to go. I will remain here." And he was just faced with a very gallant young, I suppose 22 or 3 year old officer, with the choice of choosing death or dishonor. And he chose death. He died in the caves. Hooper survived. Yes. So, one of my great memories before the battle broke was giving their last Holy Communion in the field to those two gallant young officers. It was their viaticum, though I didn't realize it at the time. And of course, we could hear at headquarters a tremendous, we heard the tremendous battle in A Company all that previous night, and we knew that the tremendous assault was preparing. And it was by dawn on St. George's Day, Monday, April the 23rd, 1951, that carriers with Lieutenant Henry Cabral in command set off down the road to get the survivors and wounded of A Company back if they could. The Chinese had gone to ground, fearing American air activity, and so the survivors of Able Company, who'd taken terrible punishment, of course, for the last many hours, came in, and Major Andrew's body was brought back. His other two young Lieutenants Curtis and Maycock, their bodies were not found, but Major Andrew's body was brought back. I remember his batman in tears. And that Monday afternoon, St. George's Day, with Tony Fatahockley's congregation and our doctor, who'd sewn Pat's body up in a couple of army blankets, I carried out a short funeral service, and we said goodbye to Pat and Andrew, and all we could do was lay his body out in the sun for the time being under an upturned assault craft. And that was my last burial, really, before the great battle began. And I remember when it got to 5 o'clock, troops were queuing for supper. Of course, it was a terribly tense atmosphere at battalion headquarters, because we knew that all hell was going to break out once night came. And I can have a clear picture of Tony Fatahockley moving about among men, his infectious smile and saying cheery words to them and trying to keep morale up. I can remember that very clearly. But my own reaction, I remember wanting to say stop to the minutes. It was a quiet sunny afternoon, there was nothing going on, but we knew that the Chinese were waiting for nightfall. And it was a very moonlit night, as it turned out to be. And I remember that terrible feeling of fear inside and what lay ahead of us. And one trying to be cheerful for the sake of all the men around, but inwardly I felt, oh, if anyone can say stop. And it would, you know, pass away and all remain quiet, but it didn't, of course. Later that evening, of course, the firing began, and in the surrounding heights, B and C Company was still out, of course, fighting their independent battles. And one of my great memories is that the mortars of the Royal Artillery, the mortar battery with us, I remember them firing over the surrounding hills into the oncoming Chinese. On and on, I can hear the sergeant major's hoarse voice now, giving the word fire, you know, as they reloaded. They were lobbing their missiles over the shielding hill into the advancing Chinese. And then, of course, after midnight, B and C companies were under the final pressure. Colonel Cohen had to give the order for us to retreat up the adjacent hillside to the highest possible ridge we could meet. That became, of course, Gloucester Hill, you know, 3-5, I think, didn't it? And so after midnight, we had to retreat from battalion headquarters position. And again, I have such a tremendous memory of that tremendous scramble up this steep, rocky hillside. One felt absolutely exhausted, but you knew you had to keep going. And our doctor had asked me to carry an additional pack of bandages and medical equipment and so on, which I did. And like all padres, one carries a communion case, a little larger than the case you've got there. But I simply had to abandon that. And I felt the priority now. Of course, we then thought we'd probably be relieved at death whose time if we could hold out on the ridge. And so I had to abandon my communion case and devote myself to carrying a great load of medical supplies. I felt at the time probably that was the priority. And of course that slope was absolutely alive with scrambling, panting men, myself included. And tracer, you could see the tracer bullets whipping across, you know, just above you. And they had little fireballs which seemed to hang in the air for a time. That's what a sight of that could easily visualize now sitting here. And at last we reached comparatively safe ground, well above the valley where headquarters had lain. And dawn broke. And a little later, the survivors of B Company, under Major Harding's magnificent leadership, came in from their position and joined the remnants of us. And by this time, it was the battalion headquarters, the few surviving members of A Company, and the surviving members of B Company and C Company. So that formed the final battle group. Of course, by this time, we lacked food, lacked water, batteries, and really ammunition had almost run out. And I think the spirit of the Gloucesters at that time, up on the final ridge, the final assault of the Chinese, probably epitomized by the adjutant Tony Farrow Hockley's words to a subaltern of the remnants of C Company. I hear him now, Guy, you stay here with your chaps unless you get orders from me to the contrary. If your ammunition runs out, hurl bloody rocks at them. I can remember Tony saying that so clearly. Colonel Cobb sat in his little hollow with his earphones on, still smoking the famous pipe, but we knew by this that all the relief attempts to get through to us through the narrow defiles were over. The spirit of our men remained remarkably steady, and again, I well remember a member of support company when Colonel Tom told him the whole battalion would be remain up on the higher range for the last fight. I remember him saying in his Gloucestershire voice, "This will be all right, sir. It will be like the Rock of Gibraltar up here." So the marks like that remain in your mind forever. And of course, anyway, you probably know most of this. To cut a long story short, the battle raged on through the night, and the Chinese were constantly trying to reach the top ridge to dislodge us. But we were able to, the battalion was able to carry out with its remaining ammunition constant fire. Also, American planes came down with napalm, and again one has a most vivid impression crouching in a little street down the medical center with the doctor as the American planes flew over, and they strafed all the sides of the hill, dropping napalm, etc., terrible weapon, of course, among the oncoming Chinese, and the scream and roar of that remains with you, and also in a prayer that the napalm would not reach the wrong objective. Also, another great thought, of course, was Drum Major Buss blowing the whole Royal Army calls. Chinese used bugles, you know, they ghostly blowing of these bugles to signal their advance. And at last, Drum Major Buss, the adjutant's request, and the colonel's approval, of course, blew on his trumpet all the whole run of army corps, you know, from Guns and Crafts, door boys, the whole lot. It was rather wonderful to hear that. I had been called to a man called Sergeant Eames on one of the slopes where our machine gun positions were. He'd been mortally wounded, and I went down to just to give him a final blessing and say prayers for him. We knew he was dying, and his last request to me was to, if I would write to his mother and his wife, which I promised him I would. Then I remember him just saying to me as his voice faded, get back, Padre. Leave me. Get back. Think of your own safety." And his eyes glazed, and I knew he was within a few minutes of death, really, and his voice ceased, and I went back to the medical aid post about some 50 or 60 yards away. Of course, his body was never retrieved. He died there, and 2.5 years later, I was able to write, as he requested, to his wife and mother. He was a splendid chap, and I'd developed a real sort of sense of friendship with him, as on Deans. And that was one of the last ministrations I had before being taken better. And then I remember our signals officer, Captain Reeve Tucker, who was in a bit of a slit in the hillside above me. I remember looking around at him and seeing a sort of glowing red spot, as I recall it, here. He shot right through the head. And I remember him just